buddy. Drink.
What are the Sightless Katanas, and why are they not part of the Primal Order?
Yeah, just to be sure everyone knows this, if you look at the end of the Sekhes Avodah Zarah, that's where the printers put it in, so you'll see a number of things that are called the small Masechtas or the minor Masechtas, as sometimes they're translated. And there's Masechtas Tzitzis, Masechtas Tefillin, Masechtas Geirim, Masechtas Kala, and then there's Masechtas Derech Eretz, and Masechtas Sofrim, which is a fairly big one. Even though they go by the word Masechtas, they are actually not from the Tanoim and Amoraim. Rather, what the Gaonim did in time of the Gaonim is that they decided, almost as it were, to create different treatises on subjects for which we don't have a whole Masechta. So what they did was, they were Malakate Brisas. Most of it are Brisas that are in the Gemara itself. And they took all the Brisas about Tzitzis and they made something called Masechtas Tzitzis. Now, that particular style of halachic writing was really not replicated. In other words, in later generations, when they did halachic codes like the Shulchan Aruch, they don't call it Masechtas this, Masechtas that, because they didn't want to add to the Gemara. But in the time of the Gaonim, they still felt they could use the word Masechtas for those collections. So the short answer to your question is, although the rabbis who are quoted there are the Tanoim and Amoraim, but the composition of putting it together does not date from the time of the Gemara, it dates from the time of the Gaonim. And these were the first halachic compilations, halacha l'maisa, on many of these in Yonim. They're called Masechtas Katanas. For whatever reason, they happen to be printed in Masechtas Avodah Zarah, but they have nothing to do with Masechtas Avodah Zarah. And there are Meforshim on them, like there are Meforshim on everything. And Rav Chaim Kineski in particular wrote some very nice Perushim on the Masechtas Katanas. But it's not part of Daf Yomi or Siyam Hashas or anything else. Yeah.
Is Meiser Mamonos Chiluf?
In other words, the Meiser of your money that you earn or something? Yeah. So there's a big machlokes lahalacha. There are three different shitas. Some shitas say that giving 10% of your income to tzedakah is actually a chi of the oraisa. Some say it's a chi of drabanan. And meikir hadin, we actually paskin like a third opinion, that it is a minhag Yisrael, it is a custom that Jewish people have accepted, which in turn makes it obligatory, but it starts off with a Ritaras minhag. So three different shitas, we paskin like the third opinion. Now, Maaser is a quite complicated halacha because it's very similar to filling out a tax return, lahavdil. In other words, when you pay taxes on essentially your net income and you deduct a lot of your expenses. So with Maaser, you have a very similar calculation. The money that you spent in order to earn your income, various travel expenses and the like, are actually deducted from your income base. So what somebody did a number of years ago, this is, of course, taxes change every year, but they produced... Now, the American income tax form is called the 1040. So they produced a Meiser form 1040, which put in all the different deductions when you calculate, and that determines how much you owe for your Meiser. It's a good idea. Yeah.
There's many stories in the Holocaust of mothers having to smother their babies in order that they wouldn't get caught by the Nazis.
Yeah.
In a case like that, would the baby have a din roida?
Yeah, so this is exactly the issue. I'm not aware of many stories. There is one famous story that is said over in many different sources. And the way the story is normally told over is it was in the nature of an accident, meaning to say a baby was crying, mother was trying to keep the baby quiet in order that the baby give away the whereabouts of all the Jews. And Rahmanul Islam, the baby was smothered and the baby died. That's how the story is commonly told over. But you're raising a very, very excellent question, and that is, if the baby's crying is going to give away the whereabouts of Jews who are all going to be killed, so the question becomes, does the baby become a rodev? Now, if the baby becomes a rodev, not only are you allowed to, so to speak, accidentally smother him, you would be allowed to actually kill him. Now, the first thing that might come to your mind is, well, how could somebody be a rodev? If he's a baby, he doesn't have negative intention, he doesn't want to do anything, but it's clear from the Gemara that a fetus can be a rodef, right? That if a fetus is endangering the mother's life, the Gemara says, and the Rambam so paskins, that the heter of aborting the fetus in order to save the mother's life is because we deem the fetus to be a rodent. It's very clear that a rodent, if a two-year-old is brandishing a gun and doesn't know what the gun is, and there's no way I can get the gun out of his hands or whatever, if Chas v'Shalom he's about to shoot somebody by accident, he's called a rodent. So it would seem quite logical, as difficult as this is, that a baby whose cries are endangering the lives of other people would halachically be an involuntary rodef, and as a result you would be allowed to kill him. The only svara to be mechalek is, well, in the case of the kid brandishing the gun, the kid is the actual person who is going to kill somebody. In the case of the fetus is going to kill the mother. Here, the baby's crying is not killing anybody. The baby's crying simply gives the Germans access. So in that sense, you might say a svara that it's one level removed. Nevertheless, the poskim do say, as a result of the baby's cries, it's a psikresha, it's a certainty that the Germans will discover, the Nazis will discover the whereabouts and will kill the Jews there. So the fact that the baby's crying is not a bullet, so to speak, the baby is still a rodent. So it's a very, very tragic situation, but that would be the case, yeah.
If a secular Jew texts you on Shabbos, emails you on Shabbos,
He texts you on Shabbos?
Yeah, Shabbos
is over here, but it's still Shabbos in the States. Are you allowed to reply? You should not reply. You should not reply because, number one, on a basic psychological level, you're endorsing or supporting the idea that if he is Mechal Shabbos, he will get a response from you. Number two, depending on the technology, it's not entirely clear you might be causing him to do extra malachos if he'll type back a short response or something else. So both in terms of not giving him encouragement and in terms of not causing him to be mechallel, possibly be mechallel Shabbos, you should not respond.
I was always under the impression that Hashem's name Kel Shakai has to do with things revolving around nature, natural cause of things. And if that's the case, why do we spell that name out with the straps with our tefillin?
Well, Shakai, of course, is the abbreviation for Amar Li Olam Odai, which means the world was undergoing creation, and logically the world should have kept on going. The seeds of wheat should have turned into stalks, and the stalks should have turned into flour, and the flour should have turned into bread, and logically there ought to be bread coming out of the ground and even on our tables. At some point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu stops creation to leave the world in a state of incompleteness so that we would become his partners. That's why the Shem Shakai is used for Bris Milah. Hashem didn't complete us. Hashem left us incomplete, so that we would be misakein ourselves with Bris Milah. That is why Kel Shakai, the first time it appears, actually is in connection with Bris Milah. Well, the idea of tefillin, why we have the shin dal yud, is actually a very, very similar idea. Because what tefillin does is, tefillin takes the kedusha of the psukim of the Torah, the parsha of Shema, which is the existence of one God that is my king, Vayayim Shemoa, my acceptance of the mitzvos, and the idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, to basically say that Hashem didn't simply create a perfect world, but a world in which I have to be a person who brings Hashem's Kedusha into the world. So Shakai basically says that we, all of us, are partners with Hashem in bringing Kedusha into the world. So it is not so much that Shakai is about nature, as it is, Shakai is about the Ribono Shel Olam leaving the world in a state of incompleteness, so that I become his shutav in completing the world. And that is what we do by our Torah, by our mitzvos, and by everything else. So Shakai is very appropriate, because it reminds you that you can't just assume the world will be holy. You, all of us, have to make it holy by the meisim that we do.
I was wondering if you could please discuss the math of reincarnation regarding neshamos, because earlier in history there were fewer neshamos, and now there are presumably more neshamos, and there's reincarnation. So how does that work out?
Yeah. Well, reincarnation is a complicated problem in terms of working out the dynamics of it. Again, let me just remind people that reincarnation, which is called Gilgal, is not mentioned in the Gemara. So it is not something that Chazal explicitly talked about. Reincarnation is mentioned by the Ramban. The Ramban does talk about reincarnation, and of course, the idea of reincarnation is extensively discussed in Kabbalistic literature, particularly by the Arizal and by the Talmidim of the Arizal. The Ariz Talmud Mufak, Rav Chaim Vital, who actually was older than the Ari, but he was the Talmud Mufak of the Ari, wrote a whole sefer called Shar HaGilgulim, in which he shows how so many people were Gilgulim. In fact, Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgul of Hevel, according to the Arizal. I'll try to address your question in a moment, so I'll give you a little bit of interesting information. Everybody remembers the passage in the Haggadah, which is a Mishnah in Brachos, where Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, "Behold, I am like a person that is 70, and the Gemara explains he was actually 18, but when he became the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, his beard turned prematurely gray, so he looked like a man of 70, right? Everyone knows the Gemara in Brachos. The Arizal says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was a reincarnation of Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi died at age 52. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was born with a neshama that had already spent 52 years on earth. So consequently, when he was 18, his neshama had spent 70 years on earth. So therefore he says, "Behold, I am like a person that is 70. Now, you are certainly correct that there may be, possibly, more people alive today than, in the totality of the past. And then, of course, people also ask when there's Tichiyas HaNesim, just another question. Well, if my neshama went through 10 different people, which one of us comes back? And that's also relevant in terms of, who you're going to be married to or whatever it's going to be, and the like. Now, the answer that's often given is that the neshama that comes back for Tichiyas HaNesim is the guf, or the guf that comes back with that neshama, is the guf in which the mission was completed, which would tend to be the last one. But again, you're going to have a problem about matching husbands and wives because they may not have been in tandem, so to speak. Okay, but you're asking a different question. You're not asking about the end process. You're asking about the interim process where souls are still being recycled. How does the mathematics work out? The short answer is that souls are divisible. That happens to be the fact. In fact, that's an answer to the Chesed Mason question as well. It is entirely possible for two people to share one soul, for 100 people to share one soul, because souls are part of the infinite essence of God, and therefore it can be divided any which way. We hope with the husband and wife, in some sense, they share soulmates. That's a literal statement in some ways. But even people that you never met, right? You may have your soul mate, same gender soul sharer, somewhere that, in Australia, and you'll never meet them, but in point of fact, they share a soul. So the dynamics of reincarnation are very, very complicated. We really don't have a clear picture, and the Rambam even tells you not to worry about it because you're not going to be able to figure out how logistically HaKadosh Baruch Hu does this. But I can tell you that souls can be split and souls can be shared, and that would avoid the problem that you're raising. Yeah.
I remember taking a class in university. The professor mentioned that Maase Merkava, Maase Bereishis, were these like processes where the rabbis would wrap themselves in like these scrolls and recite certain incantations. I was wondering if that had any makor in Kishkari.
I'm not familiar with the wrapping themselves in scrolls. Now Maase Bereishis, Maase Merkava, Maase Bereishis are the secrets of creation, and Merkava are the secrets of God's divine chariot and throne of glory, which are described in Perek Aleph of Yecheskel. Right? Yecheskel had a great vision after the Chorban of the Beis HaMikdash of the Kisei HaKavod, very mysterious vision. Maase Merkava in particular is the deepest part of Kabbalah. If you ever look at the art scroll in Yecheskel, which was written by a Rebbe of mine, so he gives you like just a simple translation of the Maase Merkava, and on every page he has like a package of cigarettes. Do not delve into this during this. This is dangerous to your spiritual health and the like. So Maase Merkava is the very, very deepest part of the essence of divinity that's really beyond us. So the Gemara does discuss in Chagiga at great length about the madregas of Kedusha that a person needs for Maaser Merkava, and the Mekubalim talk about deep levels of meditation that you have to achieve. So in a sense, what he's describing is roughly true, but I don't recall, and certainly there were incantations that were recited, but I don't recall wrapping themselves in a scroll. If he's talking about a Sefer Torah, Chas V'Shalom, that would be totally forbidden, and you wouldn't be allowed to do that. So that part, I don't know where he got from. But I just want to say one thing about this. You know, Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Zatzal, who was a great Talmud Chacham, and also a person who learned much Kabbalah, he wrote three books on Jewish meditation. And one is just called Jewish Meditation, one is called Meditation and the Bible, and the other is Meditation and the Kabbalah. And it was his thesis, based on very good sources, it's very logical, that states of prophecy and divine inspiration came, well, they don't come because of meditation. This doesn't mean any person who meditates becomes a Navi, but if you're a person that's deserving of this, in order to get Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh, you need to enter very, very deep meditative states. And even if, you know, we're not on that madrega, his argument was that within the Torah tradition, a deep meditation can connect a person to Hashem. It, of course, elevates your tefillah and everything else. And he was the one who kind of, you might say, koshered what was regarded as an Eastern type of thing to show that it is indeed part of the Messiah of Torah. And some have even said that the meditative techniques of the Eastern religions actually come from Avraham Avinu, because the Eastern, the Oriental nations, are the B'nai Keturah that Avraham sent away after Sarah's death, and he sent them to the East, and he gave them gifts, and some learned those gifts were the Oriental wisdom. But Rav Aryeh Kaplan talks about different meditative techniques, but he actually says at some point, when you meditate on the name of Hashem, Yitke Vavke, you need to have a buddy with you. You shouldn't do it alone, because your neshama might leave your body and it won't want to come back. So you need somebody to kind of hold you, keep you grounded. There actually is this idea that the neshama becomes so connected to Hashem that it leaves. And once it leaves, it doesn't want to come back. So it's always been my feeling, again, maybe I have no business saying it, you know, he died very young. He did die very, very young. Children, he died before the age of 50. And it was my feeling a little bit that it may have had something to do with the fact that he was indeed going into these very, very ecstatic madrigos that he himself said could cause a person danger. And it's no accident that the great Mekubalim often died very, very young. Of course, we have exceptions. Rav Kaduri Zatzal lived over 100. You know. But the Arizal died at the age of 38. Rav Moshe Cordovero died at the age of 48. So there's a kind of a history of the deepest levels of Kabbalah. It's not that Hashem is punishing. It's not what it is. It's the other way around, that the neshama is so connected to the pure ruchnias that it no longer can be in a body. So be very careful when you get involved in these inyanim. One has to be very, very careful. It's not just a game, and it's not just a pastime. Yeah.
First of all, on Seder night, why do we have the cup of wine for Eliyahu Navi? And also, I heard that when we open the door for him, it's that we're hoping that he's going to come and tell us that Mashiach has come.
Yeah.
But can Mashiach come on Yom Tov?
Okay, that's an excellent question. Why we have a cup for Eliyahu Navi? So countless generations of parents tell their kids, Eliyahu Navi comes to every Seder and drinks from the wine, and they ask the kid to watch the cup very carefully, and when he goes to the bathroom or something, pour it out a little bit or shake the table and the like. Now, this story is half true and half false. It is true. It actually is true. Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every Seder. Now, how he coordinates that is a little difficult, but he does show up, and this is actually an onesh. It's an onesh. Because when the Jewish people were over the Avodah Zarah, Eliyahu Navi complained to Hashem and said, reject this nation, they're not deserving, they annul your bris, they don't keep your covenant. So Hashem felt Eliyahu Navi was judging Klal Yisrael too harshly. So Hashem said, oh, you don't think they keep my bris? You gotta go to every bris that they do in the world. That's why we have the chair of Eliyahu Navi, And every Pesach Seder is also connected with the Brit. So Elio coming to a Seder is in Chazal, but Elio drinking from the wine is not. In fact, he has so much traveling to do, it wouldn't be advisable. Now, the cost of Elio HaNavi is because of the following. You know this. We talked about this in the Chumash, those that were there, so forgive me for repeating. There are four terms of redemption. Votseisi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Lakakti, that Hashem said to Moshe. And because of that, we have four cups of wine during the Seder. However, there is a fifth Lashon. I will bring you to Eretz Yisrael. And we say that that fifth Lashon is not going to Mekuyam till Mashiach comes. And since Eliyahu HaNavi is going to announce the coming of Mashiach, we set aside the fifth cup and we say we are going to drink it when Elio announces the coming of Mashiach. Right? That's why it's called the Kos of Elio, because it is the Kos that we will finally drink only when Mashiach comes. That's the simple reason. By the way, Sephardim, unless they got corrupted by Ashkenazi customs, Sephardim do not have the minhag of Kos Shel Elio, but many do it anyway, but whatever. But it's a minhag Ashkenaz. It's not in the Gemara at all. Now, the question about opening the door, because Elio HaNavi is walking in. Well, you're 100% correct. Neither Elio HaNavi nor Mashiach, Elio HaNavi will not announce Mashiach, nor will Mashiach come on Yom Tov. In fact, the Gemara says he doesn't even come on Erev Yom Tov, not to interrupt our preparations. So the opening of the door is not because you're expecting an actual announcement. You're not. But number one, it's a symbolic way of expressing the hope that we'll be zochet to Mashiach, even if it's not going to be this minute. But number two, the other reason that's given has nothing to do with Mashiach, actually. It's simply to do to the idea that Pesach night is called in the Torah Leil Shimurim, a night of special divine protection. So at that point, we open the door to show that we're protected. Some people have a custom, I'm not going to say to do it, because, you know, there might be reasons we're not always zeichah, that they don't lock their doors Pesach night, that they leave the doors of their house open Pesach night because of Leil Shimurim. That is also why in Kriya Shema Al Hamita, even though you do say Shema and Hamapil, but you know you don't say the other stuff that we do for protection, because we say Pesach night is a time of protection. Leil Shimurim. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav elucidate any Jewish sources on why Jews of different backgrounds appear different. For example, Ethiopian Jews are black, and Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews have different facial features and skin tones. And I guess an extension of that question would be, given that all men descended from Adam, why, or what's the Jewish opinion of why there is such a diversity in racial appearance?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Those are two different questions. I mean, the idea of how you get different facial features over a relatively short. Now, remember, our chronology is going to be a relatively short number of years. You know, we're not talking about millions and millions of years. We're talking about 5,774 years in which all human descended. In fact, not even from Adam. I mean, even Adam's pool was cut down. It's all from Noach, right? Noach's three sons, Shem, Ham, Yafes. Now, there is a Chazal that says regarding the black people that was almost like a miraculous, instantaneous change, that Ham was cursed because of what he did to Noach, that they were cursed with blackness. So that kind of was a automatic thing that happened. But still, as I say, it's not just black and Caucasian. You have, within Caucasian, you have different types and the like. I don't have a clear answer as to how this could be accelerated over such a fast period of time. Obviously, environmental issues have something to do with it. Obviously, there are genetic mutations that can allow different things to happen and find their expression. But your particular question about the Jews is really another question. That is, even if we could explain how descent from Adam could result in all of these different races by genetic mutation, but still, if you have a Jewish people that are descended from a single source, how do you get these differences? So one answer would actually be Geirus, converts, right? There were all sorts of non-Jewish blood that got introduced. In fact, it has been posited, although it's discredited, but it was a very popular theory. Someone suggested an author suggested around 20, 30 years ago, that the vast majority of Ashkenazic Jews are actually descended from the Khazars. Now, if you've learned the Khuzari, you know, the Khazars, this is a true story, the Khazars were a nation of, in Russia, a tribe in Russia, of Gentiles, and the king had a dream, and the king converted to Judaism, and the whole nation converted with him. Now, the Khazars are now extinct as a separate entity, but the Khuzari is based on Rav Yehuda HaLevi. I mean, he made up the dialogue, because it's really his ideas, but it's based on the imaginary discussions that the king of the Khazars had with a great rabbi as to why he should accept Judaism. So the Khuzari used the framework of that true historical story as the basis of his philosophy. Now, there was a theory that the vast majority of Ashkenazic Jews are not descended from the children of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, but they are descended from the Khazars, which would account for the Ashkenazic lighter complexion and the like, as opposed to Sephardim, that might be more authentically the way Jews looked in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? So Sephardim are the real Jews, and Ashkenazim, well, I mean, Geirim are real Jews too, so Chas V'Shalom, I mean, but the Ashkenazim are the Johnny-come-lately Jews, that we were not originally Jews, we became Jews in the process. Now, that's a controversial thesis, and not everybody agrees with it, and you'd have to have some genetic testing, but even if you don't go that far and say a majority of Ashkenazic Jews are descended from the Khazars, we can still say that there's been enough conversion and, God forbid, even intermarriage in some ways. Because even if the father is not Jewish, you know, the mother's Jewish, the kids are Jewish. So even in identifiably Jewish families, there might be intermarriage and they'd still be Jewish children, which could attribute to a different Jews looking different in different parts of the world. But it is actually a very excellent question, and it's a very, very difficult question. Because a common origin, you would assume, would have common appearances, and yet that's obviously not the case. Yeah?
Since Rabbi Akiva and many others gave up their lives rather than stop learning Torah, does that mean that it's a Yarrow Bar Yaakov?
Well, there are two answers to that. First of all, as a general rule, learning Torah is not one of the three mitzvahs for which you have to give your life. So, for example, let's say a person is very sick, and the person is told, if you learn Gemara, you know, today you might have an aneurysm or something. The halacha is you're not supposed to learn, right? Pikuach Nefesh has priority. But the problem is, the Gemara says that that is not true. The distinction between the big three and everything else only applies if it's not Pikuach Nefesh. But when there is what is called a shas hashmad, meaning to say, when the non-Jewish oppression is trying to take Jews away from their religion, is trying to destroy Judaism, then you are mechuyev to give your life for the smallest deviation from the Torah, even if it's only a minhag. The Gemara gives an example where Jews wore a certain color shoelace, and the non-Jews wore a different color shoelace. It's not even a halacha. But if they're doing it to get you away from being a Jew, you must give your life. So certainly, when a government... So the difference is... So pay attention to the difference of examples. If a person is sick, and because of his health he can't learn, it might endanger his life, so then I say pikuach nefesh is more important. But when the government says, if you learn Torah, we're going to kill you, that's clearly a law that is designed to take Jews away from Judaism. That is what is called a shas hashmad. And a shas hashmad, you are mechuyev to give your life. Now, another answer simply is this, that this is a big machlokas. Let's say a person is not mechuyev to give his life in order to avoid a transgression. Are you permitted to be strict? Let's say somebody goes over to me and says, work on Shabbos or I'll kill you. And he's not doing it to take me away from Yiddishkeit, he's just doing it because he wants me to do work for him. So the halach is I'm allowed to do work to save my life. That's right. But am I allowed to say no and get killed? So it's the Rambam's position that there's no such thing as optional martyrdom. You're either chayav to give up your life, and when you're not chayav to give up your life, it is forbidden to give up your life. That's the Rambam's position. However, many Rishonim have many riots against the Rambam, and they say that tzaddikim, who are willing to be moser nefesh for any mitzvah, are permitted to do so, and God is going to reward them. So based on that understanding, what Rabbi Akiva was willing to do, because of his great Kedusha, does not automatically mean it's an obligation. Right? So you can't extrapolate from Rabbi Akiva. Now, like the Rambam, you would have a raya, because the Rambam says there's no such thing as permissible martyrdom. So if Rabbi Akiva did it, he must have been chayav, but so then I would say it's a shas hashman. But if you learn like the other Rishonim, you could learn that Rabbi Akiva's Mesiras Nefesh was in fact optional and was not something that he had to do.
What are some of the main reasons why a person chooses to hold by higher standards in kashrus?
I'm sorry, the main reasons why a person does what?
We want to hold by higher standards in
kashrus. Well, I mean, there's plenty of reasons. I mean, basically, the issue is this. Keeping kosher is a commandment of Hashem. Now, there is no such thing as a 100% level of kashrus. I mean, I hate to say it, there is no such thing as a 100% level of kashrus. Right, so everything is going to be percentages. One hashgacha might be 75%, right? Another hashgacha might be 80%, another hashgacha might be 85%, another hashgacha might be 95%. So the question is this, if I want to live a life in which I try to do the will of Hashem in the best way possible, then I want to do things that have the least chance that I'm doing something against the will of Hashem. So, if a regular good hashgacha is 75% likely that it's kosher, again, probably higher than that, but you know, it's a pretty good percentage, but there's a 25% risk, I might be violating Hashem's commandments. So I go for a higher standard. Now, the thing is, kashrus in particular, there's a special issue, because besides the fact that violating kashrus is a sin, which of course it is, it also has a spiritually contamination of the neshama. That's why it's brought down, for example, brought down the halacha, and we see it in the Medrash by Moshe Rabbeinu, that a Jewish child should be cursed by a non-Jewish woman, because since her milk was generated from non-kosher sources, even though the milk itself is not treif, the milk is not treif, but it's metamtim, it creates a spiritual insensitivity in the neshama. So that's another reason too, that even if lamaisa, according to halacha, you're allowed to rely on a less definitive hashgacha, you want to avoid what is called timtum halev. That's a very serious thing. I've heard it said, I read that a certain Magid Shir once said that when he would give a shmooze, some people would be very inspired and some people were not very inspired. These were beginners in Yiddishkeit. And he felt that those who were keeping kosher were inspired because their heart was more open to Kedusha. And those who were not keeping kosher yet were not inspired because their neshamas were dulled. It's a serious thing. Shatnas, by the way, has brought down the same thing. Shatnas, wool and linen, is also mitamte mesalev. It creates blockages in the heart. So you're not so sensitive to ruchnis. That's why they say that if a person feels they're davening without kavana, they should check their garments for shatnas. There actually is some connection to that. So that would be the basic. Yeah.
So let's say if you hold by extra, that's 75% of the food is kosher, 25% is not kosher. Does that mean when you eat that 25% food, the food you're eating is not kosher, even though there's extra in the?
Well, here is the thing. Well, you know, if it's not kosher, it's not kosher. Now, here's the problem. If halacha allows you, halacha permits you to rely on that percentage, let's say. So, in a sense, maybe I have to reformulate what I said. In a sense, you're not committing a sin by doing what Hashem allows you to do. When Hashem allows you to rely on a certain percentage, you're not doing a sin. So maybe we won't describe it as a sin, but even though you're not doing a sin, you did ingest something that b'metzias is not kosher. So you did something that Hashem doesn't want you to do. In other words, it's a tricky question. It's not a sin that Hashem is going to punish you for, because you're allowed to rely upon it. But so it depends if you serve Hashem out of love or out of fear. if I serve Hashem because I'm scared he's going to punish me, then you're 100% right. If halacha says you are permitted to rely on a certain percentage, you don't have to do more than that. But when you try to serve Hashem out of love, so you don't just ask yourself, is Hashem? But you could ask yourself, is Hashem happy with what I just did? So there's still a 25%. See, that doesn't get away. So it might make an afkamina of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. And Timtim Halev is also an issue, that even if there's a heter, if Lamaisa is not kosher, it may still be Mutampim Halev. Now, the only question I would raise is this, an interesting question. Well, so what I'm saying is something that maybe it's a little radical. That is, even when Halacha allows you to eat something, if it turns out to be non-kosher, it's spiritually detrimental. I mean, that's what we're saying. So here's the question. All of us know there's a principle in Halacha called Bitul B'Shishin, that if a substance of Isser is mixed in 60 times heter, like a little drop of milk falls into a big meat soup, and there's 60 times the meat soup to the milk, or even chazer, a drop of chazer, pig juice, you're allowed to eat the whole thing. So now, let's think about that. Well, okay, let's say I see this chazer going into the soup. I'm allowed to eat it. Should I say, well, I'm allowed to eat it, but I know there's chazer in there, so I'm worried about my spiritual welfare? Now, you would think, based on what I said, that, yeah, there's a good reason not to eat it, unless you're poor and et cetera. The answer is, but the Rishonim say, Pumpakir, the Rishonim say, anybody who says, I'm not going to eat this soup because I don't rely on nullification in 60, is an apikaris, because he is mavaza, he is degrading the halachas of Chazal. So, what's exactly the difference? You know, it's a subtle difference, but there is a difference between statistics and nullification. When something is nullified because it's mixed into a larger quantity, then halachically it is non-existent at that point. As opposed to the 75-25, you know, I'm eating the meat, so if it's not kosher, that's what I put into my system. So you have to differentiate between the leniency of Bitul B'Shishin and the leniency of a stated percentage that something is kosher. That's a different type of halacha. Yeah?
I have a friend. He was adopted when he was very, very little, and now his parents converted him to Judaism.
When he was a baby, little. Yes.
And now he's almost my age, and he's totally gone off the derech. And they never informed him that he could go back and renounce his Judaism.
I'm sorry, he had an Orthodox conversion?
Yes.
And he was raised in a Shomer Shabbos family?
Yes.
Okay, now he's off the derech. Does he know he was adopted?
Yes.
But he doesn't know he had the right to renounce his conversion.
So
yeah.
Is it better to tell him and then just have him renounce it and not do any more averus, or wait for him to do tshuva and then tell him, so then maybe...
Yeah, just a little background, which everyone understands this. The Gemara in Ksuba says that even a newborn baby can be converted, even though he's not capable of consenting, because becoming a Jew is a good thing, it's called a zechus, and we are allowed to confer benefits on people even without their consent, unless they say no. And therefore a baby can be converted. This is what Orthodox parents do when they adopt a child, right? They put him through a non-Jewish child, they put him through a conversion. This is called the conversion of a ger katan, a minor. Now the Gemara says, however, since he actually did not agree, so even though the geiris is chal, when he reaches the age of 13, or in the case of a girl, the age of 12, they have the right to renounce their conversion. They can say, I don't want to be Jewish, and then the whole geiris is butta. But they only have one day, normally, meaning to say, if they don't renounce it on their birthday, they don't have to convert again. Some people say they have to go to the mikveh again. They don't. If they don't say, I don't want to be Jewish, then that is called an acquiescence, and they're Jewish. They cannot renounce it afterwards, like any other Jew. That's why I tell parents of adopted children that don't be too rough on your child as he's preparing for his bar mitzvah, because he might pull a fast one on you. right before he has to read the parshas, I'm out of here. You know. Yeah, so be careful about that. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that says that the only time we say if he didn't renounce on his birthday, he's a ger, is if he knew he had the right to renounce. If he never knew that, then at whatever age he finds out, 45, 50, 60, 90, on the day that he finds out he has the right to renounce, he does have the right to renounce to the end of that day. So that would mean, in other words, that if a child doesn't know that he's adopted, or even if he knows he's adopted, but is not aware of the halacha, that he is permitted to renounce his conversion, at whatever point he becomes aware, he is permitted, he is given one day, it may not be a whole day, but the end of that day, it's not 24 hours, it's, you know, sunset, and the like, he has the right to renounce, and if he doesn't do that, he's then Jewish permanently. So the question that's being raised is a very excellent question. That is, so let's say you have an adopted child who was converted halachically. Halachically, he's Jewish. He has the right to renounce, but he's never heard of that. In the meantime, he's become unreligious or non-religious, totally off the derech. And perhaps, if he would know that he has the right to renounce, he would just say, I'd rather be a goy. But since he doesn't know, he doesn't think he can do that. He doesn't know he can do that. So the very excellent question is, as a concerned friend, should I tell him of his option? Because that way, if he becomes a goy, he is not sinning, he's not doing any averse, he could eat chazer and be mechalel Shabbat. It's not chilul Shabbat. Or do I say, well, listen, as long as he's a Jew, there is a possibility of tshuva. That's a very, very excellent question. I don't have a definitive answer. My instinct would be that he should know. And let me point out the following. Even if he is not religious, that doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't want to be Jewish. In other words, the renunciation is not, I don't want to keep mitzvahs. The renunciation is, I don't want to be Jewish. So it may very well be that he'll want to be Jewish. And in terms of your concern about tshuva, the truth is, if he annuls his conversion, he can always reconvert. He can, you know, so the idea that he could still be a Jew and still do mitzvos, and maybe based on his education, that's what he'd want to do, that's still possible. So he's not losing that koach. So I would think that he should know. And Rav Moshe says he should. Huh?
If he renounces it, does it retroactive?
Well, it appears from the Gemara that it should be retroactive. On the other hand, this is very tricky. I'll tell you why. Let's say we convert a baby, and God forbid the baby needs hospitalization, so we're mechalel Shabbos for that baby, because pikuach nefesh, he's a Jew. And yet, if you say the conversion was retroactive, it turns out we were mechalel Shabbos for a goy, so what was our hetzer? Okay, then that's a tricky thing. But the pashtus is it is retroactive, which would mean, in effect, that perhaps he erases all of his averos, as it were. But he can still have a new start. He can become a Jew if he wants to become a Jew. So I don't want you to get in trouble with his parents. His parents might not be very happy about it. But Rav Moshe suggests that the child should know at any age. Yeah.
Would this child's mitzvahs also retroactively be erased? The errors go and the mitzvahs go.
Yes, they would. They would. On the other hand, let me just mention another principle. Let me just mention another principle that's relevant here. That is, by mitzvos, we have a doctrine that a good thought is equivalent to an action. And therefore, it is possible that if a person did mitzvos because they thought they were Jewish, even if by virtue of their own later action, it now turns out they were not Jewish, Hashem might for the good thought behind. In other words, they've annulled the action, but they haven't terminated the thought. You see what I'm saying? Of course, this is tricky because that principle itself may only apply to Jews. There's the concept that the good thought equals an action is only if he's Jewish. Okay, that's a tricky thing, but that's a possibility. Yeah.
I've heard there's a machlokus about if the entity of black magic exists, and on the side that it doesn't exist, so what would the Egyptians in Egypt, where the Torah says they would be turning their stars.
Yeah. I mean, the pashtus of the Torah is very, very clear. The pashtus is that there is such a thing as real magic, powers of impurity, etc. And Paro's magicians, Paro's Chartumim, were doing real magic. And when the Torah prohibits engaging in magic, It means real magic, which is why you're allowed to do magic tricks, according to that. You see why? Because the Torah doesn't usher the illusions of magic. The Torah ushers, like this opinion, real magic. And since the average magician does not do real magic, so, you know, tricks are okay. See, according to that, that's why even at Haredi birthday parties, they may have a Haredi magician doing card tricks or whatever it is. So the pashtus is that magic is a reality, although we don't believe that anyone today has those kochos. However, there is a view in some Rishonim that magic is in the nature of hypnotic things or illusions, delusions, sleight of hands, and the like, which means it's not real. Now, that's a tremendous chumrah, by the way, because if you're telling me there's no such thing as real magic, then when the Torah says don't engage in magic, what is the Torah saying? Don't engage in the illusions of magic. That's a big chumrah. That means that can't do magic tricks. There is such a view. We paskin like the other view that the Torah only answers the real magic. So once again, I mean, you're going to have to say under those circumstances that Paro's magicians were experts in hypnosis or whatever it is. I mean, there's a magician, actually he's a Jewish guy, David Copperfield. He's a very, very famous, the world's most successful magician, like a multi-millionaire out of this. A Jewish guy, David Copperfield, is a stage name taken from Charles Dickens. And I don't know, he makes airplanes disappear. I don't know exactly how he does it. I mean, he took a 747 and he made it disappear. I don't know. I mean, you know, a magician takes a Shavua Chamurav in the Kitas Chayv, it's not to reveal how they do a trick. I mean, so, you know, I mean, it's really like the key of Mises. But apparently, what that means is that apparently there is a Chochma in which just by tremendous optical illusions, you can do phenomenally amazing things that would seem to be impossible. But again, the pashtus of Chazal, and certainly the Mekubalim, is that Kishuv is a reality. Kishuv is mamash a reality, and that's what the Chatume Paro did. Yeah.
The Gemara says that it's greater to serve a Talmud Chacham than to know Torah. Don't we say that Talmud Torah can only put on?
Yeah. The mitzvah of Talmud Torah is certainly the greatest of all mitzvahs. But basically, the idea is that serving a Talmud Chacham is a way that the Torah itself will teach you and elevate you in a different way. Because Torah is designed to make you a certain personality, and the more we learn, the more we're ma'amik, the more our personalities can, in theory, undergo aliyahs and changes and transformations and closeness with Hashem. But the point basically is, when we learn, we're working within the limits of our personality. So we really can't even envision exactly, how do I become a greater person? How do I become a better person? Through the shemush of an actual Talmud Chacham, you actually see the greatness, and then you have a role model that when you go back to learn, you then have something to strive for. So the Gemara doesn't mean that if I have, you know, 6 hours a day to either learn or be Meshamesh Talmud Chacham, I should take the 6 hours to be Meshamesh Talmud Chacham. But it does mean that through the greatness of the Shemesh of the Talmud Chacham, my learning will be greater than it would be if I wouldn't have had that. And that's a very important aspect, that it is Kedai to take time to connect yourself to Gedolim. Now, another aspect too is that serving a Talmud Chacham has some specialized explanations. It doesn't, I mean, it does include, you know, giving him a cup of tea and walking him, but very specifically, it also means seeing how he paskins shilas, meaning to say, you can learn Shulchan Aruch, and you can know all sorts of halacha, but you don't really know exactly how to apply it to actual cases. So Shemesh Talmidei Chachamim is often used in the Gemara to observe the practical way that halacha is applied in real life. The sensitivity to people, what factors do you weigh, when to be meka, when to be machmir, when do you give a person a lechatchila answer, when are they really on a b'dieved madrega that you have to tell them. The Chazon Ish used to call this the fifth chelek of, right, there are four chelekim of laws. The fifth chelek is the seichel of how to apply those laws. So in that sense, Shemush is not getting away from Talmud Torah, but it's the particular part of Talmud Torah where you have personal interaction instead of learning from the Sefer, right? So it's not a contradiction anymore. That is, that itself is going to be a Talmud Torah. Yeah.
Why did we need to build the base of English as opposed to just keeping the Mishkan?
Oh, why didn't we just use Moshe Rabbeinu's Mishkan? Yeah, that's a very excellent question. But I'll give you two answers. One answer is that since HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that we would sin and we would be deserving of Chorban, it's brought down that any structure that Moshe Rabbeinu built could never have been destroyed. So the Mishkan could not have been our Beis HaMikdash because HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that it's Saifei Lecharev, and therefore it had to be something that is Shayach Chorban. Moshe Rabbeinu's Maisi Yadayim is not Shayach Chorban. The other answer is that the Mishkan, by definition, is a movable structure. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Yerushalayim to be the permanent place of Hashras HaShechina. So it wouldn't make sense, so to speak, to have a temporary, movable structure on the Har HaBayis. That would imply that that's not our permanent place for Hashem. So therefore, it had to move from temporariness to permanence. That would be a second answer.
How much due diligence must one do to ensure the kashers, people who they will be eating with Shabbos, both here and in Kislev?
Well, you know, again, this is a tough question. The short answer is you got to be pretty conscientious about this. In Chutz La'aretz, absolutely, you cannot take anything for granted. That's 100% true. In Eretz Yisrael, there might be a little more leniency. I'll explain why. Obviously, if someone is not a Shomer Shabbos, you cannot assume their food is kosher. You need to know, and even then, you need to be very, very careful as to that is. But even people who are nominally Shomer Shabbos, you know, if they're not necessarily careful, remember, in America there are many different options of kosher. There's the conservative movement gives hashgachos in the United States, and suffice it to say that's not very, very reliable, and the like. I still remember once, many, many years ago, my wife and I, we were invited to someone's house from Lao Manga. They just captured their kitchen, and we were like the first people that came over, and Nabisco at the time, none of their products were kosher, and you know, we're eating, and you know, I assumed they had a chizkis kosher, and the cracker Triscuits, you're familiar with that? Triscuits has an OU now, but you know, then I wasn't aware that it had an OU, and I remember, you know, they served crackers, and then all of a sudden something, I got worried. Gee, I never saw these crackers before, and I saw Triscuits, and I said, oh, no, Triscuits not kosher. And I started choking and coughing and gesturing to my wife wildly and everything else. but it turned out that Baruch Hashem, that the family was meticulous, and there was a tiny microscopic OU on the cracker. They had just begun, so, you know. Anyway, okay. But apropos of nothing in particular. But anyway, the thing is that you have to be very, very careful. Now the truth is, if you can ask a rabbi, I mean, you know, it's very hard for you as an invited guest to start asking a whole bunch of questions. But you ask a rabbi that knows them, etc., and see what he tells you. You know, many rabbis have a policy, by the way, they will not eat at any congregant's house, because if they can't eat at everybody's, they don't want to embarrass people. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, in one level it's easier, one level it's harder. In other words, in Eretz Yisrael, it is very hard to actually be treif. It's not that easy. Meaning to say, if somebody is Shomer Shabbos, by law, any hashgacha is at least by the Rabbanan. In other words, there's no such thing in Eretz Yisrael, legally, as a hashgacha that is below the Rabbanan, like a private hashgacha, like conservative movement, or whatever it is. So you know for sure that it is at least a Rabbanut hashgacha. Now, that's good news, because that does tell you that in all probability it's not treif. On the other hand, as you know, among B'nai Torah, we generally tend not to rely on a regular Rabbanut Hashgacha. We either require Rabbanut Mahadrin Hashgacha or Eid HaChareid, you know, but that, you know, whatever Hashgachas, Reuben, whatever Hashgachas you rely upon. So consequently, So it depends. In other words, if you don't rely on a Rabbi Nashkacha, you'd have to try to verify that it's a Mahadra Nashkacha. Now, if Lamaisa you didn't verify, this is interesting, and you find yourself in a home, and it seems that they're giving plain Rabbanut, I did see a psak in the name of Shlomo Zalman Orbach that he said that since Rabbanut is b'di'evit an acceptable hashgacha, if it would cause embarrassment or machlokas, you are permitted to eat the food. That's a very, very important psak.
Permitted or required?
Well, it would seem to be that you're required, actually. In other words, because he's basically saying that, in other words, Rabbanut is a very good example of actually your exact question, meaning I can't give you an exact number, but Rabbanut, let us say, is a 75% kashrus level. So according to halacha, you're allowed to rely on it, actually. I cannot tell you a Rabbanut is great. And in point of fact, Rabbanut Hashgacha is much better than it was 10 years ago. Precisely because Rabbi Yashiv Zatzal, one of the things he did behind the scenes, is he was very instrumental in putting mashgichim, charedi kailo mashgichim, in regular Rabbanut. So they wouldn't need it themselves, but as a result, the standards are higher. So it's a little bit of an open secret that even Stam Rabbanut, let's say, has gone from a 55% level, I can't tell you my numbers yet, to a 75% level. So Rabbanut, let us say, is a 75% level. But as I say, a person with greater Yirat Shemayim and greater Avas Hashem, you know, if I can go from a 75 to an 85 or a 90, I would rather not be nichshel. But Rav Orbach's cheshbon is that the incremental benefits of the higher level in kashrus are lost or forfeited by the embarrassment and the pain that you might cause a family. So b'chiyai gavna, the balance has to work in that particular direction. But l'chatchila, you shouldn't put yourself in that situation. You should find out ahead of time. Meaning, if you're stuck, you're stuck. And even then, maybe you could work around it, you know. But that doesn't mean you're allowed to get yourself stuck. And therefore, one needs to be very, very conscientious about this. It's an important issue. Yeah?
If one were to get into a taxi right before Shkion, or Shabbos, is he allowed to stay in the Ruben Shmoshos and even into after past dates, or does he have to get out during Ruben
Shmoshos? Well, it's a complicated issue. Is the driver Jewish or not Jewish?
No, it's a regular taxi.
Well, an regular taxi.
Oh, not here.
All right, so that's an interesting question.
A longer time for him anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So the halacha basically is once you are in the car that's being driven by a guy and the guy started driving before Shabbos, you are allowed to stay in the car. In fact, not only Ben Hashmachas, I mean, you can stay in the car until he drops you off. But you got a lot of problems. I mean, number one, you cannot open and close the door because normally a light turns on. You cannot handle money because of muksa. So what are you going to do? I mean, that's the problem. And you can't carry your wallet if there's no Erev or even with an Erev, it's muksa. So, yeah, I mean, if you paid them ahead of time and you got nothing on you, you can finish the ride. Although even then, there's an Inyan of Marisayan. But you're going to have a problem with money and with muksa, and where do you leave your stuff?
But the narrow
question you're asking me is you can stay in the car, yeah. Yeah, you don't have to jump out in the middle of...
Oh, let's just take to you don't have to get out right before.
You don't have to get out, yeah.
One
other question. There is another issue, though, which might apply. It wouldn't apply in an urban area, and that is, if you're driving around in the country, there may be a violation of tichum, meaning to say, if you've gone more than 2,000 amos from the city after Shkia, you're in real trouble, because when you get out of that cab, you can only move 4 amos. And that's gonna be for 24 hours. So when there's a tichum issue, you are in very, very big trouble. But as I say, in an urban area, typically there will not be a tichum issue, like New York City. I mean, you're not gonna have a problem. Yeah.
Why are most Jewish texts not punctuating?
You're referring to vowels or punctuation? You mean specifically?
No, periods, commas, colons.
Yeah, well, you know, punctuation is relatively new. I mean, if you go back to, ancient Greek texts are not punctuated either. I go back, you know, Homer didn't use periods, exclamation points, and quotations. Punctuation is relatively modern. And it's true that, when we republish books, we put in punctuation, but, we try to keep our svarim, you know, the way they were. There are punctuated Gemaras, by the way. You know, there you can get Gemaras with vowels, and the like. But I would withdraw any punctuation or question marks and the like. But the evidence is that, those are classics, but you're asking what about modern Svarim? That's what you're asking. In other words, if somebody writes a Sefer today, so the classic Svarim, we simply try to preserve them in the format that they were handed down. Now, you might ask a question about a modern Sefer. If I write a modern Sefer, why don't I put in punctuation? A lot of modern Svarim do. Some do and some don't. Some say, well, let's just follow the classic ways Svarim were written. Others say, if it's a new Sefer, I could, put in whatever I want. So there are different views about that. Some modern Svarim do have regular punctuation. Yeah?
What makes Shlomo HaMelech the wisest of all men, say, over, Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu?
Well, it's hard for us to know. I mean, in Malachim it says he understood the language, it says, of animals and plants and everything. Now, language presumably means spiritual essence of things, not so much talking and the like. So it seems that he had a deeper understanding of the processes of the universe than anyone ever had. So Avram was greater in righteousness. Avram was greater in Emunah. And again, this is not a criticism of Shlomo to say such a thing. Avram is the foundation of Emunah in Hashem in the world, but it could be that Avram did not have the depth of the full understanding of how animals, plants, minerals, how everything interacted. So it seems that Shlomo's wisdom was he saw the of how the universe functions. So did you have a question?
Because in some places the Chutzlaretz, the kosher authorities will investigate products that might have the hechsher on the packet.
Yeah.
Is it true that products in Chutzlaretz that are made for Rob Goyim that you can mevatel and isul the chatzila?
You're talking about in the factory? Mevatel, are you being mevatel or the factory being mevatel?
The kosher ingredient is less than the bottle of shishi.
Well, let me put it this way. That's very true, that if a product is being made for primarily non-Jewish customers, then even if they deliberately introduce a non-kosher substance with the intention of it being nullified, that would be permitted because they're not doing it for Jews. In other words, they're not doing it for rogue Jews. That's correct. But that would not be permitted on the retail level, meaning once I buy the product, I would not be allowed to put in a non-kosher ingredient and be mevatel et b'shishim. But yeah, basically, if it's rov akum, we don't call that a bitul isser, because for the guy, it's not there's no isser. So that is correct. Yeah.
I was at Simcha last night, and there was rabbanut meat together with more kosher than a list.
You had a choice.
Well, no, the chicken came together with meat. So would we be able to eat the chicken if it was kosher?
In other words, the chicken was mahadrin, and the meat was rabbanut, huh?
It was I think.
Why? Did the trays come with labels on them?
No, the plate comes with a piece of chicken on top of it.
Yeah, but how do you know which? How do you know?
Well, there's a list.
There's a menu before.
All right. So the question becomes: So essentially, they touched. I would say, since this does not involve embarrassing anybody, because you're at a wedding, so nobody knows what you're eating. So I would say, if everything was hot, I'm assuming they were hot, one should be a little strict. But technically, what you'd have to do is you'd have to try to ascertain the surfaces at which there was touching, and just scrape off a little bit of the layer. In other words, the whole chicken is not going to become tainted because they weren't actually cooked together. They just were touching together. So you just have to scrape off the point of contact.
Similar question. If you're going to somebody who holds a rabbanut, for example, but they're prepared to make a better hesher for you, are they going to be making it in their...
You do not have to be machmer. That's also very important. That if your host, you are mahadran hashkacha, and the only chisaron is that they're going to prepare the food in the pots and the cutlery, which was used for rabbanut, you certainly do not have to be machmer in that. And that's even lechatchila. In other words, when I told you lechatchila be machmer, that's when they're going to serve you plain rabbanut food. But if they're only going to use rabbanut pots, even lechatchila, you do not have to be machmer. So you're okay. Yeah.
I heard that crows, snakes, and dogs are like cursed animals, and so it's not such a good idea to have them as pets. Like, what can I tell? Is that like, is it Issa to have a dog as a pet?
No. Well, the point that you're making about crows, snakes, and dogs is because there's a medrash that says that in the Teva, for the year that Noah was in the Teva, none of the animals had intercourse, not to create population, except for those three animals. They violated this norm of tznius and overcrowding, and therefore they were considered to be cursed. On the other hand, from Chazal it is mashma that you are allowed to have a dog, because Chazal say in Bava Kamma, it is forbidden to raise a vicious dog. The implication being that a non-vicious dog is permitted. And we also find that the Torah says because the dogs were silent during the plague of the firstborn, we reward the dogs with non-kosher meat, you know, nevela, and the like. So generally speaking, there is nothing about a pet crow, I don't know. Pet snake. If a snake is dangerous, you're not allowed to have it. That's true anyway. If it's a dangerous snake. But dogs are permitted, and in fact, at least I know of at least one gadol that had a dog. One of the great Bali Musar had a pet dog for various reasons. I think he wanted to show. And dogs are very good in terms of giving children responsibility and also showing them friendship and love. Now you may notice that many religious Jews are afraid of dogs. And even regarded as a phobia, and they try to train their children not to be afraid of dogs. And part of that is historical. You know, it happens to be that, you know, in the Holocaust, Nazis used vicious attack dogs. And before that, in the Middle Ages, when Jews worked under the Polish landowner, the Poryts, he used to scare them with vicious dogs. So for among Ashkenazic Jews, maybe Sephardim or less so, among Ashkenazic Jews, there was almost a genetic fear of dogs from that very, very long history. And of course, there's a vicious catch-22 about dogs, because when dogs sense fear, they think it's aggression. So in effect, if you feel scared, you want to get more scared, because the dog is more like you when you feel scared, and then you get more scared, and then the dog's more likely to attack you. So you're in a difficult bind, as it were, because the dog thinks fear is aggression in and of itself. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with dogs. Now, there are shilas about owning a pet. Number one, animals are muktzah on Shabbos. Number two, walking a dog when there's no erev might be a problem of carrying if you have a leash. Number three, spaying or neutering pets, which is absolutely necessary, otherwise you'll have unlimited reproduction, happens to be an issur d'oraisa. So if you're going to buy a dog, buy one that's already been neutered, because you're not allowed to really get it neutered. And number four, there are going to be issues of diet. Now, feeding a dog non-kosher meat, you know, dog food, is perfectly okay, but Pesach will be a shiloh of chametz in the food. And if it's a mixture of meat and milk, since that is not only usher in eating, it's usher in hanah, that you're not allowed to feed to your dog. So there are shilohs. And then, of course, the other shiloh is bikkul Torah, which is always an important thing, because dogs are different than cats. I know, Ar Samach, we have our pet cats, adorable kittens here. But cats, as you know, are independent creatures. You know, they show up once in a while, and then they do their own thing. A dog, you got to spend a lot of time with. So a person has to make a cheshbon. Good, dogs are nice things, but how much time am I able to give? How much time should I give? Right. So these are the unim you have to think about. Yeah.
Are you allowed for hot chocolate sauce onto ice cream on Shabbos from the issue of bishul and nylon?
Yeah. So the issue of bishul is this: if the hot chocolate is yatzah lettuce, bro, let's miss that out. Yeah. So the question becomes, and you're pouring it from a kli rishain, uh-huh, right? So you're pouring it from a kli rishain onto ice cream. So generally speaking, Yirei Kli Rishayin is considered to be an Isser of Bishul. The only question is whether the ingredients in the ice cream are already Mavushel, because the milk has been pasteurized, which is more, right? And then the question becomes, what about the other ingredients? If, you know, you'd have to know more about the manufacturer of ice cream. Are all of these subcomponents cooked already? Because if they are already cooked, there might be a mukum to be makel, even if it's iri kli rishon, on a dover that's already mavushal. And then the shaila is, if you look at ice cream as a dover yavesh, then for sure it's okay. But even if it's a dover lach, the chumrah of lach shen its tanein is a chumrah, in which case you could you'd be soymech on the iri kli rishon. Okay, but so there might be a bishul issue depending on the ingredients. Now the issue of would largely depend on your kavana. Meaning, if your kavana is not to liquefy the ice cream, even though it's a psikresha, that would not be called nylon because you're not interested in a melted pool. If, however, for whatever reason you actually want to generate the liquid, then there would be a shayla of nylon. But if it's stamazai going to be, it'll melt, but it is not your kavana that you want it melted, so nylon is not osur b'chiyah kavana.
Is one permitted to make a ceviche on Shabbos?
A what?
Ceviche?
I have no idea what that is.
small pieces of fish that are cold cooked in lime juice over a very short period, an hour or two.
In other words, you soak it.
You soak the fish in an acidic juice for an hour or two to cold cook it.
And there's no heat?
No heat.
There is no heat. So this is a big machlokas, because the machlokas is this. Normally, to be called bishul, bishul is not simply food preparation. Bishul is heat. And even though for treif and the like, we considered pickling as cooking, for all the laws of treif, but for the laws of Shabbos, we don't consider it to be that process. But, so bishul is not going to be your problem. But there might be other problems. There might be, for example, according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, there's an Isser called Makeh B'Patish. You know, Makeh B'Patish is the last hammer blow. Mm-hmm. Like making a kli is forbidden. So the Yerushalmi says, making the inedible edible, even if it's not through heat, might be Makeh B'Patish in Eichlin. And number two, putting something in lime juice for a prolonged period of time, Midrabanan is forbidden to pickle vegetables. Because Chazal saw a resemblance between pickling vegetables and tanning hides, which are also immersed in acidic substances. And tanning a hide is a malacha. Right? So I would say that your problem would either be Makeh B'Patish, which might be a Doraisa problem, or it would be the gezeira of pickling vegetables, or pickling fish, for that matter, which would be an Isser Drabanan because it resembles Ma'abe. So it's mistavra to me. I didn't see a direct psak that it would be Isser for those reasons. Okay? Have a good day. We'll see you later. Is that Mara for an 820? Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.